Hey everybody, just a quick little advisory. This episode is not going to be bleeped at all. We're trying something kind of new. So just letting you know, don't be too shocked. Welcome to Mere Flies, everybody. I'm Ryan.
I'm Josh.
And I'm Greg.
And today we have a very special guest. Everybody welcome Holden McNeely.
Woo! What's happening, everybody?
Welcome, welcome.
Now, Holden, we are about to give descriptions of guests that we have on here, so we're going to let you do it. So stand up, tell the class a little bit about yourself, who you are, who is your daddy, what does he do, and if you had a childhood pet that you'd rather not have, which one would it be?
All right, let's go ahead and say, my name's Holden. I do a podcast called Wizard and the Bruiser. We take a topic and I guess you want to call it nerd culture. It's anything from comic books to movies, video games, whatever. And we do an hour. We do like a research-based podcast. Last week it was Shadow of the Colossus. I also have a Twitch stream, Holdenators Ho, on Twitch. I do a ton of different shit on there, namely play Japanese dating sims with my friend Jackie, or even do live sketch comedy. Let's see, childhood pet that I wouldn't want to have? Okay, yeah. Can you repeat that question?
If you, out of all of your childhood pets, which one would you eliminate from existence?
Okay,
wish you'd never
had? My parents got a dog late in my sort of childhood life. It was near the end of high school. And all I ever wanted, my brother and I, we always wanted a dog. And they brought home this like floofy little dog that only liked my dad, that hid in the closet and wouldn't be friendly to anybody. And it was just like the worst, the opposite of what you want. It was like they found a way to make that awful.
It sounds like they got you a cat.
Yeah, they got a cat essentially in dog form. It was a Cavalier King Charles Spaniel. It was awful. So I would definitely probably get rid
material.
Of that one. And they would always go. They would call for me for dinner at night, and they would go, "Area, Holden, it's time for dinner." Like literally every night, they would call me the dog's name. Just to add insult to injury. My father was a corporate lawyer. He's now retired. Did I get them all?
Got the kindergarten cop question. I was not expecting an answer from that one. All right. So today, if you haven't guessed already by either reading it or by the guest that we have on, we are going to be talking about video game myths today. It is going to be a wild ride. We got a little bit of everything. We have a good bit of like word of mouth rumors. We have some economical rumors. We have some practical rumors and then some paranormical rumors, something like that. We're going to be covering the whole range of everything. And a little bit about this is that something that I noticed just in the topics that we're going to be covering is that this kind of mostly focuses on a range of time between like the 80s to the early to mid 90s. And I think the main reason why that is, and I think Holden, you can speak on this, is because those were the Nintendo Power or Electronic Gaming Monthly days. There was no internet to dispel anything. Nowadays, with any sort of video game, anybody can just like crack open the source code and tell you every sort of feature that is in there, will be in there, or was supposed to be in there but just got left out.
I mean, just arcade culture in general was such a phenomenal, just wonderful time. I remember when, Mortal Kombat 2 came out, and even just the basics of, like, not knowing what fatalities, how to do fatalities unless you went out to the arcade and, like, just hung out and watched people do them and then was like, how did you fucking do that, dude? Like, that was, like, the only way to find out. Like, you couldn't just go Google it or whatever, which is now just kind of immediately the way to kind of ruin all of the sort of that kind of feeling of like the mythology, the secrecy around it and everything. And so of course rumors would also come out of that as well. So things that weren't true, things that, you would spread word of mouth. Dude, I totally made there's a code you can put in Mario or it'll make him big as the screen or some shit like that.
I remember that one. Well, I did that.
If we're going to talk about a game that actually did do something like that, we're talking about NFL Blitz. That was great, just being able to button mash like a motherfucker and get everybody as Raiden.
NBA Jam getting to play as like Bill Clinton and stuff like that and getting all those codes, again, just like word of mouth, people passing around or going out to the magazine stands, picking up a Nintendo Power or something like that and, immediately flipping to the back of the book and getting all those like hot codes, those sick codes.
So I do have to ask one question. Did you ever own a Game Shark?
I did not, but I feel like, again, it was such a social aspect to right. Like, you know, it was like going to a buddy's house and they had right. a Game Genie, you know, a Game Shark. I don't even know if I ever fucked with a Game Shark. Game Genie, though, I remember that like crazy because I was a Sega Genesis kid. So I'd have to go to my mm-hmm. friend's house to get that Nintendo, Super Nintendo and the Game Genie.
So I remember, like, my specific word of mouth phenomenon that I had in school was, I mean, Holden, you're a little bit older than us, but not sure. by much. But I was still a sentient for the days before you could go on the internet and look up anything, like days uh-huh. before game FAQs. And I remember specifically the one, it was all based around Pokemon Red and Blue. And
oh,
I remember
God, so many.
Now there is Leafeon in the main, like, Pokedex, like it is an actual thing. But back then it wasn't. I remember having to go to like the giant Poke Center, the Pokemart, I think. And it was something like you had to give the little girl on like the seventh floor like 500 lemonades, and then she'd give you a grass stone so you could make a Leafeon out of Eevee. Wow. And then there was Missing No, which actually did work, but
Missing No worked.
Crashed
I couldn't
the game.
Believe it worked. That was one of those things that you heard that you were like, there's no way that works. And I totally got Missing No to work. Because I was I think I had Pokemon Blue. I was a blue kid because my buddy got red, and I was able to get all 151, right?
You had to use that weird thing, right, with the old man teaching you how to use a Pokeball and then going up the coast. That was such a wild one.
Oh, yeah, you had to, like, get him from under a – no, that was Mew that you got from under a truck.
Yeah, that was – yes.
As you would find all Pokemon.
Yes.
The truck-type Pokemon. But also, I remember seeing something like – the other big one was the Triforce during Ocarina of Time. I think during the, like, Japanese development for – I think one of the 3D platformer Zelda games for N64, in the Japanese version during the testing, there was a picture of, like, boy Link, like, young Link holding the Triforce. And there was this whole thing about, like, throwing a bomb under Ganon's castle – and then it would, like, drain the lava. You could go into the Temple of Light, and then all of a sudden, you can get the Triforce. I spent a good week of my childhood time after school trying to do that to no avail. And also, I feel so stupid because I was an idiot as a kid, and I remember that when my parents got me Ocarina of Time, they got me the gold cartridge, but it was used. And, like, it already had a game file on there, and I didn't really realize that I wasn't playing a new game file. And there was, like, nothing to do because he had gotten everything except from going to Ganon. It's like, this is boring. I'm returning this. And now I just have the regular cartridge, so I got screwed.
That's crazy. You just, like, created your own story in your head that, you know, is just this bored wanderer, that's yeah. like, all-powerful wanderer.
Why do people
like
love this game?
Fallout beta.
Yeah, right?
Fallout beta.
Josh, you got anything like that before we jump into the topics?
Well, I was going to say, I was thinking when you were talking about not having the internet, the first game I remember ever actually looking up cheat codes and things like that was for GTA 3. That was the first time totally. I remember sitting down, you know, the L1, L2, R1, or whatever it was.
L1, down. R1, L2, R2.
That's it.
Left down, right up. Yeah.
That's the first one I remember because I'm playing the game and I'm like, this is so hard. I don't know what the fuck to do. And I was like, well, we got this thing called the internet with dial-up, so let me get on there real quick and see what's going on.
3 hours later.
And then that's when I discovered, game FAQ. And I remember, like, just seeing, I was like, where's this been all my life? And it never dawned on me that there was games before that we could do that on, like NFL Blitz, like you mentioned before. My cousin,
you little sports kid,
was the only one who I remember telling me, like, oh, yeah, you can get a big head. You can get infinite turbo. Or you can do this, that, and the other. You can do this with GoldenEye. Like, all that shit, I had no idea how we ever knew about it. And it was because of EGM.
And another thing with that was, too, is I remember handwriting all of that shit down,
yes,
too.
Yes.
So, like, every single one of my video game, like, cases had a handwritten little, like, piece of ripped-out legal paper, you know, or something where I'd have all the codes in. And I love – that's why any game nowadays that forces me to actually pull out a piece of paper and start writing shit down, I, like, instantly love it. An example of that from recent time is The Witness.
Oh, I was going to mention The Witness. I haven't beat it, but I love that game so much.
I absolutely love that game, and I loved that it forced me to pull out a sheet of paper and actually start writing shit down and getting, like, that engrossed in the game. It kind of brought me back to a time in gaming that I miss.
Oh, the worst is when you realize, no spoilers to the game too much, but you can't listen to music while playing the game because it uses all senses. It even uses
audio.
Smell.
Yeah.
But
Smell-o-vision.
We ready to jump in?
Yeah.
All right, Josh, you take off.
So the first topic this evening, I'm going to be talking about Shin Long.
This was a Holden requested topic. Yeah, actually.
Yes. I was going to say, Holden, is there anything you want to talk about off the top about Shang Long?
Well, I just, you know, recently I fell back into Street Fighter. I've been playing a lot of Street Fighter V. I'm actually hosting Saturday Night Fights tonight on Twitch. We do a battle lounge with some buddies and we hang out for a couple hours. But yeah, I just remember this one from recently on Wizard of the Bruiser, we did a Street Fighter episode and I regretted that we didn't actually get to this. So I was happy that you guys gave me the perfect excuse to cover this topic. The mythology of Shen Long and the whole, because especially when this was a time when there were other, I think, what is it, Noob Saibot in Mortal Kombat?
I think where it was actually, Smoke was the original one. That
Smoke was
the
original
yeah.
one where you actually, it actually was true. You had to do a bunch of weird stuff in the game. And if you did the, you know, the XYZ exactly correct, you know, you would get to fight against, you know, this hidden character. But in this case, of course, it was actually completely false. But anyways, yeah. So I was real happy. I had an excuse to do this one.
Just to, so I avoid a penalty shot. I think it might have actually been Reptile instead of Smoke.
Oh, I think you're right. Oh, okay. I think it was Reptile.
But whatever.
Yeah. So, so Shang Long was a character that was thought to be unlockable inside Street Fighter II specifically. The name Shang Long was based on the mistranslation of, and I'm going to fuck this up, like I do every word that I don't
Wait,
know.
Wait, the English?
Yeah, Shoryuken?
Oh, you must defeat my Shoryuken!
Yeah, there you go. It's found in one of Ryu's early victory quotes, which is, you must defeat my Shang Long to stand a chance, which also sounds like my Friday nights. the origin of this, you know, we're big here with the origins of things, Holden. And so the origin of this actual rumor goes back to a 1992 EGM, which is Electric Gaming Monthly magazine, and it was published in April, which... When one thing that we've noticed around here on Rumor Flies is when something's published in April, you need to check what day in April specifically, because that's where you get in trouble with April Fools.
So I think the interesting part about this, though, is there was already a seed of doubt when you mentioned the mistranslation, because I think people were already questioning who is Ryu Shen Long or what is Ryu Shen Long.
Right.
And does everyone else have one? But it's I think like this is where they ran with it pretty much.
Yeah, basically they gave you the stipulations on how to unlock them. You would have to play as Ryu and you couldn't take any damage until the M. Bison stage. Then you must not hit M. Bison or allow him to land a hit for 10 fucking rounds. So good luck with that. Only then would Shang Long appear to throw M. Bison off the stage to face Ryu. The timer would freeze at 99 and it would be a fight to the death. Now, Shang Long was described as having incredible powers. He had fireballs that were faster than Sagat. Am I always saying that? I always forget how to say that. Sagat?
Sagat, yeah. Sagat's good, yeah.
Okay. And the spinning kick deadlier than Chun-Li, and had a special attack that would absolutely kill you instantly. Now, in the show notes for the show, I have a picture of the actual article, and if you read it, your bullshit meter should immediately start to go off the screen.
Well, it's because they said he was broken in every way. The way they wrote him, they said like he didn't have like the little delay between shooting a projectile and stuff.
There was no way to defeat him, basically.
Yeah.
Well, also just not getting hit by M. Bison for 10 rounds is like the perfect impossible thing. You know, like there's no way anyone would.
Saturday fight nights with Old McNeely. Learn how to avoid M. Bison for 10 fucking rounds.
Also, too, it's like it's the kind of thing where you could, even if you were to somehow manage to pull it off, and then you know Shang Long didn't appear, you could always say to yourself, maybe I did just barely get hit that one round. You know what I mean? Like
that
there's
little
no
seed
way to
of
prove
doubt
that you didn't get hit.
Yeah. Well, if you look in the article, there's an honorable mention to W.A. Stokens, which, if you put it together, it's Waste Tokens. And he was from Foldigan, H.A., which that, sent my bullshit meter off the charts because I'm terrible at geography, but H.A., there is no state. Hawaii is H.I., but if you put, it's Foldigan, Ha, when you put it all together.
I thought that just meant Hamburg. But because it was like Fuldehin, but that's what I thought it was, or some Swedish thing. I don't know. But like that one was a stretch for me, but I like it.
So, yeah, this was complete and utter bullshit, but it became so ingrained inside the Street Fighter culture because Europe, Hong Kong and other places just published this article again, stating it as fact without ever checking anything into it. So players tried for many months.
They don't have April Fools sometimes in other countries. And
they didn't take the time to talk to people across the pond. And not only that, they didn't even talk to EGN about whether they could publish the articles or not. They just took it and ran with it, which you wouldn't be able to do today, but that's neither here nor there. Mm-hmm. So players tried for months to unlock the character until December of that year. So the very end of the year, in the magazine, they released that it was a hoax. Excuse me. It was a complete hoax. So it wasn't true at all. So that pissed a lot of people off, but probably not as much as 5 years later.
But EGM was just like, oh, holy shit, y'all believe that? We like put every seed of doubt into it.
So not only that.
I would have loved to have read those letters coming in.
EGM.
Just to work for EGM, just to get to read those letters coming in from people would have been incredible.
Oh, and you also know that there was that certain person that was probably like, my dad works for Street Fighter and you guys probably put something in wrong there because I didn't get it. So you have to explain to me what you did wrong, okay? I need my Shenlong right now.
Well, fast forward 5 years, and Street Fighter 3 is in the works, and then EGM decided to resurrect the exact same fucking prank, except they took it one step further this time. They published an actual character claiming to be Shenlong, giving him a backstory, giving him features, giving him everything to think that you could actually unlock him in the game.
And he looks like Heihachi a bit, just to clear that up. Yeah.
Yes, he absolutely does. They wrote about how to unlock him. You have to get 6 perfects in a row in order for him to actually appear. And now, not to be outdone last time, to be a little bit more clear though, the first letters of the first 10 sentences spelled out April Fools, which again, nobody seemed to fucking get.
Well, it wasn't Cryptographers Weekly. So, you know, they just give them the benefit of the doubt. But eventually this just kept running to the point where everybody, even Capcom, was like, maybe we should put this in on every iteration of Street Fighter. I think there was a Street Fighter the movie game, right, Holden?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there was a Street Fighter the movie, the game, yes.
And they were trying to put him in at one point, and they actually had it all ready to go.
Really?
But they ran out of time because they ended up putting, it wasn't Akuma, but it was another character.
Goki or starts with a G. I can't remember the name.
It was not Goku, but yes, you're
no,
right.
No, it's not Goku.
I didn't write the name of that one down, but there were two characters and they approved one and then Shenlong just missed the cut. But apparently after that, there was a constant thing where just like, you know, it's too late. I think even up to Street Fighter V, they're considering including him in there, but it still has not happened. But
yeah, I was thinking how sick that would be if they would announce, because they're still, you know, coming out with seasons for Street Fighter V, where they introduce about 6 characters throughout the year, and we're on season 3 now.
People are ecstatic about that.
I know, right? Which is the worst, and it's this whole money pit or whatever. And I'm currently invested in the game, so it's terrible. But right now I haven't purchased season 3, which I would receive Blanca, the ultimate troll character. But Shenlong, also Dan. People really want Dan to come out. He's like the ultimate like troll character. He's just this kind of wackadoo dude. But
he's like
a
joke for you.
Yeah, he's like the joke Ryu. I was hoping he would come out as well, but he hasn't. But yeah, Shenlong, man, come on. I don't understand it. They're sitting on this perfect kind of, you know, gold mine of publicity if they would just come out with that character and just make him like obnoxiously powerful too, like totally unbalanced. It would be super fun.
They did a list of the 20 most or the 20 best Street Fighter characters, and he was number 19. Shenlong was 19. Not even a real fucking character. They put him 19 for being so influential and basically pissing off so many people. And it's regarded as one of the biggest hoaxes of all time in video game history.
And once again, it's a word of mouth thing. There was no way to confirm it or deny
it
because
exactly.
You couldn't just rip open nobody had the resource to rip open a cartridge or a cabinet and just check it out and see what was actually in the code. But
the good old days.
If anybody wants to actually play as Shenlong, there is a Shenlong character pack in Mugen for Street Fighter. And you actually have to, which is kind of just like this open source fighting game that you can just have so many different characters. Like you can play as everybody from like, you know, anybody from Street Fighter to Soul Calibur to like Doug, you know, just anybody. but somebody put Shenlong in there and you have to unlock him in that sense. Like you actually have to get to M. Bison and I think it's only one round for this, but you still have to do it.
Really?
Yeah.
That's really cool.
So, is that Shenlong?
That's Shenlong in a nutshell.
All right.
Hell yeah.
Moving on to the economical one that we were going to talk about is E.T. the video game, and whether this particular game for the Atari 2600 was buried en masse, and I mean by the millions, in the desert of New Mexico because it was responsible for crashing the video game market in 1993 in North America.
It's a weird part of history because everybody looks back on the Atari as kind of that first console that kind of changed the game. They put video games from the arcade into houses, but Atari also almost sank video games
forever.
Yeah. Almost completely ruined video games for all of time because of E.T. and you know, other kind of, I guess we can call it shovelware that was coming out for Atari at the time.
Now, Holden, I want to ask you, for this, we all watched the documentary Atari Game Over. Have you seen
it? Yes, I have, and I it's a great doc. Is it still on Netflix, guys?
No, I had to rent it off of YouTube.
But I did find out that if you have an Xbox, it's free in the Xbox Marketplace because Xbox produced it.
Oh, awesome. Oh, very cool. It's a great doc. It's got some really cool cameos. The guy, what's his name? He wrote Ready Player One.
Ernie Cline.
Yes, and some other great. It's good. It's solid, and definitely, you know, especially its coverage of the crash of the console market during that time.
So we're going to be taking a little bit from the documentary, and then we're going to be adding a little bit of our own stuff to it because they didn't talk about the crash quite as much as I would have liked in the documentary. Mm. But it covered what we're about to talk about. So just going to go ahead and jump into it. Video games in the 1980s were a bit different than now, obviously, but mainly if you get a picture of it. Back then, it was the roaring 1980s. Everybody either had a Fairchild Channel F, a Bally Astrocade, a Magnavox Odyssey, an Intellivision, Emerson Arcadia 2001, a ColecoVision, a Vectrex, or an Atari 2600. All in the homes of little children. A game console for every child. Essentially, that is what you can think of right there. There were so many different consoles to choose from back then, and it was just like this booming market where everybody was just kind of trying to figure out what was going to happen with these home video consoles because they're trying to beat out the arcades at this point. Now, I think at this point, arcades still had another good 15 years before they would have their death knell. I think it wasn't until the N64 that they were truly killed off.
I'd agree with that.
Would that be a good litmus test for it? I mean,
I think so, because I remember... I remember we didn't really have a video game arcade.
Fun Arcade. Yeah. Veterans.
I remember we had Fun Arcade, but we didn't really have much else. But I remember going to Pizza Hut all the fucking time with the buffet, which is a really age statement right there.
Yes,
and,
man.
And I would just play play. Yeah, hell yeah.
Oh, I read so many books and got so much pizza. And I remember the Casper cups that you could get.
Yes.
That was fun.
But mine had the Neo Geo machine with a Samurai Showdown. I remember that was like main jam.
Mine was Blitz and Gauntlet Legends.
Nice.
Dude, when I found out I could rent Gauntlet Legends for N64, I just blew my mind. Yeah. I was so excited. I played so much Gauntlet Legends with my friends. I lost it.
Well, we're actually thinking about playing Gauntlet Legends. Well, the new Gauntlet game. It's got Gauntlet 2014 on Instant 3 Play at some point. Anyway, that's nice. Not here or there. But anyway, like the video game industry was like competing with the arcade industry still. It was still a very real threat to both each other. So there was everybody trying to get in on the cash because they knew that kids would go for this. And we're talking about the price of video game consoles back then. You think it's expensive right now?
Oh, they were so fucking expensive. Yeah.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. And it was in like 1982 money. Like $300 went much more than it does today. But
that's a house payment.
Yeah, and just as a little reference, in 1983, the video games industry, the home console industry, was worth $3.2 billion of 1983 money.
B, billion with a B.
Fact checker Greg, go ahead and check out what that converts to, and then we'll get to it. However,
give me the year one more time, 1970. 1983.
3.2 billion.
And pretty much at some point during this year, everything crashed. Everything started seeing a plummet in their sales. And there were so many different culprits, anything from like saturation to third-party developers to just games in general. One of them was considered they're both on the Atari 2600, which seems to be, aside from the Intellivision, the console that came out on top in these console wars back then.
Also, I think a good thing to remember, too, is like unlike today where you have these AAA titles with just like, you know, hundreds of people, you know, or at least like, you know, upwards of 100 people working on a game. Back in the day, it was might just be one person making a game, two, three people tops. You know?
Yeah.
It wasn't, they didn't have the kind of support they did back then. And they kind of, I don't know, I feel like dev companies or console makers sort of gave game makers the shaft in a sense of support. Like, they just kind of were like, yeah, just go make this thing. How quickly can you get this thing pumped out? All right, we got to make some money here, you know?
And we have an exact example of that.
Yep.
And the main culprit of the video game crash is E.T. the Extraterrestrial for the Atari 2600. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about Atari and the general atmosphere. And if anybody watched the documentary Atari Game Over, you may be a little bit familiar with it. But we're going to talk about the atmosphere and a man named Howard Scott Warshaw, who was the, I want to say, sole author of the game.
Yeah, he was.
And so,
yes.
Unlike so many Japanese developers, there were no caves or rivers being discovered or searched around for inspiration for this. It was just straight doobies and J's in an office, and it was like, it was party zone, and they happened to play video games.
What was the tagline?
Yeah,
the movie?
It was like,
it was, we take fun intravenously.
Yeah.
I read, you know, Live from New York and watched that documentary about Atari. Very similar. That first season of New York. Just getting really fucked up making games or writing comedy.
So back then, I guess it was kind of like a little bit extra to spare economy, and everybody was just having fun with what they were doing. Everybody was making tons of money and able to party. And the best part was it was simultaneously. Atari headquarters back in the 80s was pretty much, they literally had hot tubs in the courtyard. If they met quotas, the boss would throw a kegger. This particular person, Howard Scott Warshaw, specifically said that on his first day at work at Atari, he had heard from somebody about kind of like what the mood is there. So he decided to bring a joint with him to work just to be like, that was his in. Instead of bringing donuts to work to impress, you know, Karen and HR, he would bring like a fat ass joint. And the deal is, he got turned down for it. Like, when he ran to the first person and said, oh, sorry, I'm smoking here, I hope you don't mind, I'm going in this room, so get out if it's not your thing. He's like, oh, no, I brought a joint. He was like, get that shit out of my face. I have good shit.
Yeah.
I have developer money shit.
And
so,
fun little fact, you should know that Howard Scott Warshaw knows how to party because he went to Tulane.
I saw that.
Yeah, he went to Tulane, which is a university down here in New Orleans.
I saw very briefly. He's a psychologist now.
Yeah.
It's weird. But anyway, so everybody was just banging out games because I think they had a little bit more leeway, because with the games that did come out at the time, when just the console makers were making the games, that's all you had. Everything was amazing no matter what you looked at.
Well,
you know?
He said Atari owned 80% of the market share.
Yeah, right? It was
so
something.
He was like, I'm the only developer ever put out. Every game I made was over a million copies. Well, part of it's that you dominate the market.
Yeah. This guy was a little bit, he was a well-deserved prick about how accomplished he was. I kept
waffling between really liking him and thinking he was self-aware and thinking he was a narcissist. He would just constantly jump
like an endless
round
loop.
Those bases.
Well, yeah. You know, at one point I remember him making a statement and I was like, man, this guy sounds like so self-serving. And then he starts crying a little bit and I was like, now I feel bad, he's just really proud of himself. And then he just says something else that's just completely dickish, and I'm just gonna go with it, he's just a person.
That's a very good way of putting it. He's just a person.
He's just a person.
So it turns out that Warshaw had actually a lot of accomplishments. He made a game called Yar's Revenge, which was the first like story-driven video game for a console, which was interesting to say the least. Not going to touch too much on that, but eventually from that success, he was asked after E.T. the Extraterrestrial came out in theaters to make a video game of E.T. the Extraterrestrial, specifically by, he was being advised by Steven Spielberg.
Well, I should also point out that he also did Indiana Jones, the video game, as well. So he had some experience in taking a movie and developing it into a video game as well.
And at this point, this is when Warshaw started to get a little bit creative. He wanted to get some good ideas. He wanted to make a really good game. He was talking about how he had like this idea for like a complex 3D world, which definitely wasn't implemented in this situation. He wanted to go by like a storytelling type of thing in this game. But it turns out that somebody came up to him and said, you got 5 weeks, buddy. You think you can do it? And he goes, you know what? Sure. I'll take up the task.
And I felt like the funniest thing was Steven Spielberg talking up the game.
Oh,
like,
my God.
He knows what he's talking. He's just like, we got the best people working on it. It's going to be amazing. Science, guys. It's the future. Video games are the future.
So what I thought was funny was what you've mentioned in Wizard and the Bruiser a couple times, especially when it comes to Miyamoto from Nintendo, is that they have all these crazy ideas that they have for a development of a game. Then he walks into a room and is just like, yeah, let's just make this a little platformer. And then they have to redo the whole thing.
Yep.
It was kind of the situation with Warshaw and Spielberg. He pitched all these ideas to Spielberg, and Spielberg was just like, can you just make it a little bit more like Pac-Man? Like, that was that's pretty much what he wanted. So he tried to do as best as he could, but still making it a little bit creative. He put, debatably, the first Easter eggs of any video game in that game.
No. It was he put the first Easter egg that was allowed. Because the first guy in Adventure, I forget his name.
Which is no fun.
He did it without them knowing, but Warshaw did it with the permission of Atari.
Yeah. So it turns out that this game did not fly as well as the movie did. It ended up being a little bit terrible. I'm going to explain to you what the game actually was, because I wanted to play a little bit of it, but I just watched a whole playthrough instead. And it is hilariously bad by any standards today. If anybody has not seen gameplay of this, you are a little green ET that is made up of maybe 20 something squares at best, like pixels. Your moves are to just move around and then extend your neck. That's all the only things you can do. And I kept laughing the entire time because this was a let's play, but it wasn't the guy talking in the background. It was just straight up game, but I could just hear in my head the person cursing in the background the entire time, because you're in an open environment and there's just pits everywhere.
Yeah.
And you keep falling in a pit, and the way to get out is you levitate out of it. Like, there's just a button to levitate right out the pit, but they didn't take into account in the coding that you would have to move out the way of the pit unless you fell back in, because every time you fall into it, you would fall into it about three more times unless you hit like the left or right button as fast as possible. So it was just a constant loop of this guy falling into a pit.
Like, and it doesn't really it doesn't really communicate well, like, what's a pit, too, right? It's, like, not, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's not even...
Yeah.
I mean, at one point, you're, like, trying to pick up a... The premise of the game is you have to get the parts of a phone so you can literally phone home.
Yeah.
And then you have to get, like, 7 Reese's pieces and then find Elliot or some bullshit. And the entire time, there are two things going on. There's either a scientist that runs up to you...
And you jump on his back.
No, he just picks you up and brings you back to the Science Institute. And that's it. Like, you just go back. Like, that's it. Nothing. There's no consequence aside from you lose some time. And then there's an FBI agent that just goes and steals your shit. Like, if you have picked up a part of the phone, he just takes it, and then you have to go find it again. It's just a game of inconveniences. There is no sense of danger to it. It's just like, get the fuck away from me. It's nothing like that.
There's something about, like, the color scheme and the sounds that are in it and just the combination of all of that mixed with, like, the general look and mechanic of it that actually makes me feel weirdly depressed. I don't even know what it is. It just makes me bummed out.
Oh.
And it's like this bizarre, like, you know, it's like people should study that game for, like, how to induce depression. They should, like, use it, like, to torture people.
It's like a reverse MDMA experiment instead of trying to treat depression to try and induce it. It's like, how can we make childhood PTSD a thing? So yeah, but I thought it was quite the opposite, though. I was laughing at every step of the way. Literally, I could not get over the pitter patter of ET walking.
Yeah,
like, it just sounded hilarious. But yes, everything else, there was not much music unless you died and Elliot comes and just, like, possesses you and takes away one of your lives, just goes into you. But anyway, the game was not well received, to the point where I think Warshaw was talking about after the game, he was just walking around, probably smoking a joint, looking for his next keg to just take home for himself. And some people in the hallway were like, hey, man, it wasn't your fault.
Yeah, hey, like, man, you did the best that you could.
I would have been expecting, like, one of, like, my family members died in a car crash or something, and, like, the way they were talking to him, like, and he was like, what are you talking about? And eventually he realized, oh, shit, this game's not doing well.
It isn't his fault, though. It was 5 weeks. It was one guy. I mean, it's a marvel that he was able to get anything out to market, you know? I mean, it's shocking. Well,
and wasn't it sold millions, but it was all of a sudden, like, first couple of weeks, it was kind of cool. Like, oh, the game did well. Then the returns
and reviews happened. Started
That's what's interesting,
it.
The U-turn. Because people are like, oh, yeah, E.T. the game. Hell yeah, I'm just going to buy it. Like, we review games. Everyone's super picky now. But back then, you didn't really have that. Like, I mean, there were a lot of games coming out in Atari, but you basically bought the new big game. It's like going to see the big new movie. Garbage movies that do terribly, like, they still make tons of money sometimes just because everyone went and saw it out of just, oh, it's probably good.
Well, the fact is there became a secondhand market. There were probably more, like, used copies that you could buy for cheaper than the new ones.
And so, they way overproduced.
Yeah, way overproduced. We'll get to that. But essentially, this is where the crash started happening. And I, you know, you can say whether it's coincidence or not, we'll go into it. But this is the time when profits were plummeting. And like I said, $3.2 billion in 1983. By 1985, the market had reached $100 million. Like, it had dropped that much.
It wasn't Atari losing $300 million a quarter or something like that?
Yeah,
it was ridiculous amounts of money. They were hemorrhaging it. They were just, it was a, like, holes in a water balloon. It was ridiculous.
Greg, did you find out how much that was in
today's
standards? Yeah,
I was gonna flip it at the end and see if you remember. It's $4.8 billion.
Holy Jesus. Shit.
Wow.
It's still in the billions.
That was their highest, yeah. I mean, but still, that's billion still higher on. Than, yeah, very big market.
Wow.
So anyway, this is when,
means they're probably losing. So that means it went from about 4.8 billion currently to like 150 million, basically. Wow. So just, you're talking 90% drop. I mean, there's nothing.
This is when a lot of retailers stopped carrying consoles or selling as many games. And essentially Atari was just the way the newspaper says it was that Atari said, oh God, this game is so bad that it's killing an entire market. We are going to destroy America with this game. We need to get rid of it. So they tried to like pull like an Ark of the Covenant thing and just bury it in a landfill in the Alamogordo Desert in New Mexico. And there's an actual newspaper article talking about this, and Atari denied it. Like, they just said, no, what are you talking about? That didn't happen.
And I didn't know they denied it.
Yeah, they initially denied that they did anything of the sort. But somebody claimed to have seen a dump truck with just a bunch of E.T. the video games. I'm talking about a bunch by millions, like millions of copies going into a landfill. And this became the urban legend that there is somewhere in the Alamogordo Desert, there is a treasure trove of cursed games that would probably, if they were to be unearthed, crash the video game market again. It was like the gold in Pirates of the Caribbean. But eventually, 30 years pass by, 2014 comes up, and a collaborative effort between Xbox and Howard Warshaw, and for some reason, the author of Ready Player One, who, I'm unpopular opinion here, was annoying as shit to me in the film. But
he was fun in some moments, but he was occasionally like thrown in there to be like, hey guys, star power. I felt like there was a little bit of that going on.
Yeah, there was.
He was a little forced in the film, but it was kind of fun to have like the old school devs, the Xbox rep, the nerd culture guy. I mean, he I think it could have been better utilized.
I think,
but yeah,
when you show
he's overutilized and poorly utilized.
When you show him driving in a DeLorean with like life-size ET
that he borrowed from George R. Martin.
I thought that was actually kind of funny.
I was going to say, with a five-second cameo from the head of Westeros himself, George R. R. Martin, which is very random.
Yeah. He threw a lot of star power in real fast for some reason.
With a life-size ET sitting in the side, and he's wearing like a Space Invaders shirt or something to that extent. Like
listening to 80s music the entire way there.
Like, I don't know. It was just, it was off-putting to me. It was like, how many more tropes can I put into it?
I get he's kind of a parody of himself at times. I don't know.
But he wrote the book. He wrote the book, so yeah. I guess he has the authority for it. That's where I'm going to get. That was my little tangent that was probably undeserving. But anyway.
You were nicer than usual about it.
Yeah. I could say more things. So they turn up in the actual Alamogordo Desert. They finally convince the New Mexico government to actually dig, because the entire time they had like a councilman on there that was concerned there would be malathion in the dump, which I have worked with. It's a pesticide, DDT, another pesticide, lead, and for some reason, mercury laced pigs. They were very heavy on elaborating on mercury laced pigs.
It's a zombie animation. I thought it was funny.
Yeah, it was funny. It was just, I don't know. It kind of just like flopped a little bit. So they turn out to a landfill and they make it a whole big deal after they get the permit to dig. And it was crazy the way they figured out the plot of land to dig in. Like, they actually did have to do a like trajectory based off of one photo that they saw of the supposed burial. It was really cool.
He was basically doing land surveying. Is what he was doing.
Yeah, the guy that was running the dump was just kind of like, oh, you don't want to dig right over there. You might find some mercury-laced pigs. But
just talking like that.
Leave it dead. Leave it dead. He actually did have an interesting accent. But he helped out, and they eventually got some actual earth moving material.
Yeah, some construction companies coming in to dig up in the specific area that they thought they might
find.
Clearly didn't like the documentary interviewer. They like were so not wanting to talk to him when they interview them. You could tell they were like, oh my God, go away.
But they got a whole crowd up there who was probably asking just as many questions to the diggers. Like, you find anything?
They're like, oh my God, these nerds.
They were good intentioned, but...
But that is funny. That is a funny combination, just like Uber nerds and construction workers.
We can't even catcall any of these people in the crowd right now. They're all just nerds. But long story short, by the end of the day, they find a copy, and then they eventually find more copies of E.T. the Extraterrestrial. And it kind of confirmed this whole myth. And it seemed like Warshaw, when he was there, he was like, not a matter of if they're going to find it, just like when they're going to find it. Because it's strangely enough, I've never seen anything in this about who gave the order to go and dump these. And it by the end of the day, they found a couple, maybe 100,000 copies of E.T. the Extraterrestrial. But there was tons of other games included with it that were also just broken versions that were actually very good sellers. Like, they were very popular games.
Like Yar's Revenge, for example. And they said it was something like E.T. the game was only like 10% of the actual cartridges found.
A small amount compared to what they said it was going to be. So, I mean, yes, they did find it, but it was not the millions of copies of E.T. the Extraterrestrial alone. And Atari actually made a retraction to their "we never did it" statement, you know, 30 years later, saying, oh yeah, we just like had tons of shit in a warehouse that we didn't want and we couldn't sell, so we just kind of dumped it.
It's pretty reasonable, to be honest. Like, I mean, I'm not a huge fan of just like dumping our shit underground. Like, let's not get into that territory. But I think that like what they did was par for the course of like, oh yeah, you have a bunch of crap and you're folding and going bankrupt. I mean,
just throw it away.
Throw it away. Well, like,
it seems like, you know, reporters are just going up to Atari and just constantly knocking on the door and slapping him in the face with embarrassing questions, and they just eventually just like, we don't feel like feeding into our own abuse anymore and just becoming our own joke. We're just going to deny it. So,
but I will say too, though, with Atari, I mean, if you look at what they're doing now, they're still kind of in the "we're a joke" business. They're getting into the Bitcoin business. They are trying to sell these weird speaker hats for way too much money, just hats with speakers in them. They're still just so weirdly ass backwards business wise.
They are the game company version of the fedora tipper, I guess. Sorry,
it's like the drunk uncle was allowed to be the leader of video games for like a little while before finally like Nintendo swooped in and was like, okay, we'll take it from here.
They're gonna start selling Atari branded katanas that actually have Bluetooth connection. For
reason. Probably.
Yeah, exactly.
And they make lightsaber noises when you swish them around.
There you go.
They're going to hear this, sue us, and then take the idea.
That's fine.
But
Here, folks.
So anyway, this essentially wraps up the whole part of whether it was in the desert or not. It totally was. Now, the other question is whether it actually crashed the game market or not. And I would say definitely not.
No, I don't think so either.
E.T. the Extraterrestrial was a symptom, but not even the worst symptom of this crash that like led up to it. It happened to have been there. It was bad timing. It was just bad timing that a terrible game came out at the same time that all of this shit was happening.
And it was an easy scapegoat.
Now, as a little analogy, I think it was two main things that from what I read, and I am not an economist in any source of the like sort of the word. I read the Wikipedia page and a few other articles about the video game crash, and it seemed to be like a two-pronged front. It was video game saturation of consoles, and also third-party developers fucking everything up. And in terms of the consoles, we're going to go ahead and just make the analogy that, like, so let's say E.T. did ruin the video game industry. There was a game so bad that everybody just gave up on video games. Now imagine how bad something would have to be to get kids to stop being addicted to something that would not not require them to go outside. Like, it would have to be absolutely disastrous.
That's
not
fair.
Even E.T. that was that bad. Let's go with the food industry, I guess. So, say in Chicago, they're big into hot dogs. You have a business that decides they just want to try something new and just make, like, possum dogs. Like, possum hot dogs. And everybody hates it so badly. Nobody likes the possum dog. And then everybody decides to just stop eating hot dogs altogether in Chicago. Like, it even breaks the tourism industry for Chicago's hot dogs. That wouldn't happen.
No, it wouldn't. That's a very good analogy. I see what you're saying.
Now, however, if Wiener Circle started opening up a new restaurant across the corner from each other every week, And then other competitors started doing that too. And literally every block has 2.5 hot dog vendors. Then it might get to the point where people get sick of hot dogs. And then nobody's making money because there's so many vendors out there that they just have so many to pick from. Even their own, like the Wiener Circle themselves is losing money because they're putting out so much product, so many different ones. That would be the first analogy, and I think that's what happens with the video game console saturation. In the beginning, when I did my terrible transatlantic accent of all the different consoles that were on the market at the time, I think it was around like 8 or 9. Right now we have like 3 competing with each other, if you don't count PCs, which also was a factor. The home computer was also coming into the market at the time and just chopping into the business. So it turns out that like with all these systems, everybody was just spreading out the money and nobody was making enough money.
Right.
So that was the first little hiccup in the industry. Secondly was third-party developers. Some people at one point saw that there were video game cartridges being made, and then eventually there was a Supreme Court case, I think, that said that it could not be the company's rights to just make that intellectual property just for their system. Like other people could. And that's when third-party developers came in, and I want to say it was Activision that was the front runners in that. And they just took off with it and put out so many games in the Atari 2600 and gave them a boost for a little bit because they're mainly making it for the 2600 because they saw where the market was going and they saw that was the good console.
Right.
But then all other developers started doing that, just saying, holy shit, we could do that. Get on it right now. Get on it right now. And just making your own cartridges. And it was just these people essentially making like, you know, the Steam Greenlight.
Mm-hmm.
For anybody that's been on Steam, anybody can make a game and put it on there. However, not everybody has to buy it, but they pretty much made the actual view of the Atari 2600 look bad because they saturated the market of the 2600 and everything else with such terrible games that were worse than E.T. the Extraterrestrial, supposedly.
And of course, Nintendo solved this problem. Yep. Do you guys know how they did that?
It was the little gold seal, I want
to
say.
The little gold seal, the Nintendo seal of approval, and that was the way for them to communicate to the buyer. They had to do that because of this exact issue, to communicate and say, hey, this is sanctioned by Nintendo. You're going to get expect a certain level of quality from the game, so we're not, you're not playing like Custer's Last Stand or something like that. it's gonna be like some level of decent, decentness. Except for, it's so funny to say that though about the gold seal, because I mean, like Bayou Billy was given a gold seal, right? That game's hot trash, but still, it's better than the hottest trash that was coming out by some of these third party people.
I wouldn't mind playing an 8-bit Boston Tea Party game. It's probably not that bad, but
a lot of it's like you think of the video game industry as almost like this vacillating pendulum, right? So it's this. That was kind of a mixed usage.
Those words are too expensive.
I know what you mean.
But anyway, it's vacillating back and forth.
I'm just thinking of a pendulum just dripping with Vaseline.
Right. There you go.
That's disgusting to me.
Heirloom.
So basically, though, it's swinging back and forth of like, okay, it's such a explosive market and there's nothing out there that you can do a free-for-all and it be sustainable. Then suddenly it becomes like, it's all done in-house by Atari and suddenly people figure it out. Then it exponentially blows up and then it compresses back on itself with Nintendo's seal approval and all these companies basically, and you even see the extremes like the Wii U even recently, where no one from outside was basically let in. So you see this happen a lot in the industry or individual consoles where the allowance, Apple did this,
right.
PlayStation did this, but Apple even did this,
PlayStation,
right? Where they allowed
3
the 90s.
Was notoriously difficult to develop for,
yep.
So like nobody was, PlayStation 3 was difficult to develop for, so nobody was making, PlayStation games. But on the other side of that coin, you still have a problem today with the oversaturation for certain consoles. The Wii had a huge problem with shovelware, with just people putting out just, a million different, like, pet a dog games.
But you see this in every industry. It's the whole argument of just, like, how much of a walled garden do you create to protect yourself from, like, not just, like, other people making money, but there's somewhat of a quality control. And so that's, I think, the Atari was unfortunately at the massive receiving end of the first time this swap happened.
Yes.
Right.
On the Wii and Wii U front, I'm just saying, y'all haven't played Cooking Mama or Babysitting
Cooking
Mama
Rules.
Or they're fun, okay?
Cooking Mama Rules, man. I'm not sitting here trying to talk bad about Cooking Mama, all right?
That deserve two seals. Two seals.
Double gold. Yeah.
So anyway, that pretty much wraps up E.T. And I think we can move on to the more practical side now, Josh.
My last topic this evening is I'm going to be talking about something that every single gamer from the 90s on has done to a game. And that is blowing into a cartridge would make the game work. Also, putting toothpaste on a scratch disc would fix the problem. Now, as far as blowing into a cartridge goes, I remember doing this all the time, specifically with my Nintendo 64 and my Sega.
Which
my,
it specifically tells you not to do, Josh.
That's you're getting ahead of me, Ryan. Please stop shitting on my material. Time and time again, though, whenever I would have a problem, if I would put the N64 game in and it wouldn't read, I turn it on, nothing would happen. I wouldn't get the N64 logo, turn it off, pull the cartridge out, blow one, and put it back in. Most of the time, it worked.
Yeah, it fixed everything. If I had problems with my homework,
It worked every time.
If I was right? having problems with my homework, I'd just blow into a cartridge and then just try the problem again. You
oh,
know?
Yeah? Is that how you did it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Like I said, the simple answer, though, is that no, this won't work. And the long answer is read the fucking label, like Ryan said, because it says on there, please do not blow into the cartridge. When Nintendo designed its NES...
Okay, real quick, though.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Why did it work every time? Why did it work 100% of the time?
I have an answer.
And I like to add, wasn't the logic that the theory, basically the myth that went around was that it worked because you were blowing the dust out the cartridge?
That was one portion
of it. Right.
But I would also, if it was an N64 or a Super Nintendo specifically... I would blow into the actual like cartridge receiving slot.
I did that occasionally
too. The lady end of it. And afterwards, you would blow into that too. But it had like a dust cover that popped back up anyway. So theoretically, no dust should have been in
there.
You
weren't
the first
doing
place.
Anything good for it anyway.
Shut up, Josh. Okay. It worked.
No, but Holden, I will get to why it worked 100% of the time. I'm very glad you asked that. So when Nintendo designed its NES, it used an engineering term called zero insertion force. Like I mentioned before, that's my Friday nights.
No.
Basically, Nintendo wanted to make it to where all you had to do was slide the game in, push it down, and power it on. There was little springs that would snap into place to hold the game down, and then it would expand to pop the game out once you pushed it, and you could take the game out without any problems.
I understood that.
Thank you. Now, here's the problem. The pins to
you
move...
You said there were no problems!
Well, the one problem, I'm sorry, Gregory, is that the pins that would move the game were made of nickel, which would wear out over time, and the connectors of the game cartridges were made of copper, which would tarnish when you exposed it to air. So when you decide to blow into the fucking game, all you're doing is causing rust inside of the game cartridge itself.
I'm ignoring that.
Shut up, Ryan. The number one reason why people stand by this as a viable method, like Holden says, why did it work 100% of the time? Greg's favorite answer, the placebo effect. That is the God's honest truth.
You could make the cartridge think it worked?
There's been no study that I could find that supports blowing into the cartridge that would actually make it work. And the thing about it is that a lot of times people, they would push the game harder the second time. And so that would allow the connectivity to read one another. And so after blowing on it, that's why you would be able to actually play the game.
Oh, no. I remember for a while, like even now when we try to like play N64 on Twitch, it's old games and old system. And I kept like just jamming the cartridge in and out, but it worked for me. It was like a three-time thing. Just kept 1, 2, 3 quickly and then hit the restart button and just there was a pattern that worked. But you said pushing in just harder the next time works.
Sometimes that would work. It all depended on how rusted the cartridge was and how wore out the pins
were. Also, it's like with USB, right, where people say, oh, you put it in, you flip it, it doesn't work, you put it back, it works the original way.
Right.
And part of it's that you're more decisive. Like you're more committed to the move. I know it sounds kind of silly.
No,
it's
but
like
it makes
you kind
sense.
Of like you kind of like, oh, you kind of lackadaisically plug something in or pop the cartridge in. You're not actually really doing it properly. You're not being precise.
Also, consider the fact that when you consistently like blow and put the cartridge in and out, you might be brushing off some of the oxidized copper off of the pins.
Ah.
That is entirely possible as well, yes.
I feel like, too, you're just showing the console and the cartridge that you give a shit about the cartridge's
yes.
needs, about
like,
the console's
I really
want
to play.
I really no, want to play. If you don't
a
do
little
anything,
TLC goes a long way.
If you don't do anything, you just take it out, put it back in. The cartridge is like, what you talking about? You know, like, we're not going to, you don't even want to spend $5 on, like, you know, take me to the movies or something. You know what I'm saying? Like, you got to treat it right. You know,
mine's the abusive relationship where it's like, I'm doing this to you for your own good because I need you. I need to play you. So,
so that wraps up the blowing in the cartridge thing. The unsexy answer is it's the placebo effect. That's the bottom line. Now, as far as rubbing toothpaste on a disc,
why did Greg insist on 100% of the
it
time?
Definitely, no, look, I'm telling you right now, I don't care what the answer is. I don't know the answers. It fucking worked.
It worked.
Okay.
I showed all my friends that. I was a god for that. You cannot take that away from me. You cannot take that away from me.
Well, Greg, I'm not going to confirm nor deny your fucking divine status right now, but just buckle up and just settle in for
this. Was that
the
first thing you did when you had new kids over for a sleepover? You watch this, man.
Bring your broken games over. I got you.
Okay.
Disc cobbler.
Disc cobbler.
Greg's haberdashery of CDs.
To understand how this would even work, you have to understand there's five layers when it comes to a CD. The label, the acrylic layer, the aluminum layer, the polycarbonate layer, and the laser portion. Now, the laser portion hits the aluminum layer, and this bounces back to the CD reader. Now, when you have a scratch on it, it's unable to reflect back to the CD-ROM, and it's unable to read the data, you know, and that's when you get your skipping. Y'all have heard the skipping noises, right? Mm-hmm. I'm assuming everybody's heard that. When you put a disc in and you hear doom. It's not reading it.
Okay. That moment of truth before the PlayStation loading screen moved into the actual game, that was like always that moment of just like brace yourself for impact.
Which, my only quick sidebar, the PS2 would do that a lot to me. I remember I tried to fire it up in college. It would make grinding noises and have all these problems. I opened it up, dusted it,
and it worked.
Oh, it's been great for like another 5 years so far.
So it's funny, between,
I think it was like 7 years.
Between Carlene and I, we have three PS2s in the house. We have two large original consoles and one PS2 Slim.
The Slim ones, yeah.
And they alternate between which one works. I think you have to pick every 3 months a different one works and the other two don't.
Yeah, cool down period.
So anytime I want to play Time Splitters 2, I have to make a big gamble to figure out which console works. Mm-hmm. So
Time Splitters. Okay. So when you add toothpaste to the bottom of the CD, basically what you're doing is sanding down the imperfection. Mm. So yes, that's actually why it works, Gregory. That's, and you can
notice
even,
the just nobody can see a fucking fist pump in the way he says my name.
Nobody can see a fist pump. We're on a podcast.
Well, you can.
You saw it.
I shouldn't even mention to give you satisfaction on here. I'm cutting that.
So we, that's why you can actually use this toothpaste method on video games, CDs, DVDs, other laser discs of that sort, because all you're doing is just sanding down the imperfection and allowing the data to be read by the laser.
So I have. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's it. Go ahead. What's up?
I have a quick story about this, actually, this exact kind of conundrum that I thought was quite hilarious that this whole subject reminded me of. This is freshman year of college, you know, that year where you are stuck with people that you have to kind of hang out with because you're like a freshman from out of state and you don't have any friends yet, so you're just sort of forced to be around people that otherwise you would never spend any time with. I was hanging out at this dude's place, a total dude bro, who he just rented the NCAA college football game for PlayStation, I think PlayStation 2. We fire it up, we're going to play some football, and it gets stuck on the loadings, like the team select screen, I think it was. It just kept getting stuck, and then he was like, wait, I know how to do this. You know, I think he washed it off, he put it back in, didn't work. All right, man, I know what this is. We got to do toothpaste. So he rubs toothpaste all over it, puts it in, again, stuck on the loading screen for the team select. And then he goes, no, wait. I got it. I was told this a long time ago by a buddy. I swear it works. You got to flush it down the toilet.
I remember that one. And they would say the pressure of it, right, would strip all the stuff off. You'd hold it and try to keep from cracking, right?
Yeah, and we were like,
I remember this. Oh, my God. I totally forgot about it. Yes, I heard this too. I totally heard this.
We were like, what the fuck are you talking? I mean, fine. Do it, I guess. It's not my disc. You know, I don't give a shit. So he runs to the bathroom. We hear the flush noise. We're just like, this is ridiculous. I hate this person. I hate that I'm hanging out with a person who would even think to do this. And then he runs back out with it, you know, throws it into the PlayStation. We brace ourselves for impact. Boom. It gets past the team select screen.
What?
And we're like, what are you talking about? We couldn't believe it.
What is this voodoo?
Everyone shotgun beers afterwards and selected their team.
That is the type of bros I was hanging out with. By the way, though, it totally froze like 2 seconds, like 5 seconds.
I do have a question. Do y'all remember at the shops they would have, I was trying to Google, I couldn't find it. You could bring it in. They'd have a CD repair service. I remember I had a damaged version of Elder Scrolls Oblivion. And this was back at like Lakeside Mall, and they still had like little, you know, freaking game stores in there. Uh-huh. And the thing would actually strip off a layer of the disc. Nice. But it would strip off a layer of the disc, and it only worked once. They said you can't do it twice because the game will stop working. But from what I understood, it actually basically like borderline stripped a layer from the disc.
It would sand it down.
But it was like, maybe that's what Home Depot was doing, but it was like a very specific machine they had, and they charged you for it.
Well, you got to think that the portion of that gets read, it's like 1.2 millimeters, so it's very, very, very thin. Right. So you can kind of shave off a little bit of it, but yeah, I imagine.
I didn't know what it did. I didn't, actually wasn't sure how they did. I was wondering if any of y'all remember that.
You know, Greg, they probably just put fucking toothpaste on it.
But Holden, yeah, that you know, probably if the whole flushing it didn't work, he probably would have put it in the toaster afterwards and tried that.
Exactly, so. Yeah, burn the whole dorm room down.
But anyway, so is that all on the video game repair?
Yeah.
Yes, toothpaste, no blow?
Well, unfortunately, yeah, don't blow, but you can toothpaste on it.
There you go.
Okay. So wrapping it up tonight, we are going to get to the creepy side of things.
Rumor Fly says no blow.
I mean, it's your choice, man. I mean, we're both still against saying that it didn't work. But
that's actually a good point, Ryan. Me, my own personal opinion, fucking do it all day long because it worked for me every time. But the science behind it says you shouldn't do it. But what does science know?
Yeah, Miyazaki.
Bastard.
Wait, he had nothing to do with that.
I don't care. I still blame him.
So anyway, it was Miyamoto. I'm sorry. So we're going to move on to the creepy aspect of the night and just end it on a little bit of a spooky note. Everybody knows what creepypasta is at this point. And obviously now that the internet exists too, they've kind of mixed some video games into creepypasta. But this one goes a little bit before that. We are going to be talking about the phenomenon known as Polybius. And Josh and Greg, Holden, anybody want to jump in on the idea of what Polybius is before I get into detail?
I feel like there was a mystique to video games back in the day that they were sort of dangerous, right? I mean, this came from a few different angles. You had, like, the idea of, you know, especially more in the 90s, early 2000s with games like GTA and things like that, that it would, you know, violence in video games and things like that. But I also remember a game called like Nitrous Oxide, N2O.
Yes.
Named after a drug. It's this evil video game. And it was totally this really kind of whatever 3D sort of F-Zero style like racer that just had like some psychedelic-ish imagery and sort of like, you know, electronica music. But it wasn't, you know, it was like, and parents were like afraid of these new video games, like they were something to be like scared of, you know, that there was hidden messages in them and things like that. And also just different, you know, even more recently, or I guess it wasn't too long ago, it was like there are YouTube videos out there that the kids watch and they get high from them, you know, and that kind of stuff. And it was just, it's so ridiculous and silly. But anyways, Polybius was probably the earliest form of this kind of hysteria over a game, right?
Yeah, I think so it starts off with Portland, Oregon, 1981, a new game cabinet, which for anybody that is not in the know, means like the actual giant arcade machines that you see in an arcade, which there are. If you have one now that isn't a Dave and Buster's, just cherish that. If you actually have a legit coin-op arcade in your town, number one, see if you actually have internet connection anywhere. And then afterwards, just keep playing over there and just do not let that place close down. Support that place. A game called Polybius showed up in a small section of Portland, Oregon called Polybius, and it was made by a company known as, according to Alex from I3P, because he kind of speaks German, is Zinneslöschen. I think that's how you say it. Hopefully I got that right.
Sounds good to me.
And this game, it was a little bit vague on how it was. There was no great description of it, but some people say, well, compare it to Tempest, which, ironically enough, Holden, you just mentioned that game, Nitrous Oxide, is kind of like that, but 8-bit, where you're kind of like going in a circle, shooting at things coming up from the center of you.
Tempest is very cool. From the screen. Tempest is a very cool game. I know it's in Barcade in Brooklyn. I got to play it there.
Oh, nice.
Cool.
I think my favorite to do at Barcades is Joust. I love the ostriches. Yeah, that's a good one. But this one was kind of like Tempest. From the best I could understand, there's a few different variations of people saying what the game played like. They even had issues with figuring out what the graphics were actually like, and I'll get into that in a second. But it had an interesting quality to it. Aside from it just being, you know, an arcade game that people wanted to play, they said it had kind of an addictive property to it, to the point where there'd be lines out the door waiting to play this game. And God knows how many quarters were stacked up on top of the arcade machine for next play.
Right.
That was what I heard the most about it. But then people that would play it would suffer from anything from hallucinations to insomnia to the exact opposite, which is night terrors, to headaches, and then to like suicidal thoughts and even instances of possible murder or suicide that occurred from it. So all these things happening in one small little section of Portland. And one of the owners of one of the arcades, I want to say it was the Diamond Arcade in Portland, said that occasionally the cabinets would be visited by what they would describe as men in black. And I don't think it's meant to be like...
So Will Smith showed up with Tommy Lee Jones and they had a good time.
No, I don't think it was meant to be them or even like in the alien sense, but just like general
men in
suits.
Black is based off the concept of the mysterious men in black. Also, that show is based off of that concept.
If you guys have read the original Men in Black comic...
X-Files.
The original Men in Black comic is so much more violent and different than the movies.
I had no idea there was a comic before the movies.
Oh, the comic's good. I highly suggest reading it.
Cool.
Kind of. But anyway.
What kind of stamp of approval is that? I suggest reading it. Kind
of. The Nintendo seal of approval that this is in fact a game.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Nice.
I had to commit. I made the suggestion. If you're bored. So anyway, these people would like show up to the cabinet and be supposedly collecting data on it. Like, they'd be collecting all this sort of... I don't know if it was from, like, the handles or just, like... I think it was too early for them to be collecting, like, you know, biometric data from the person. Unless they had little cameras tracking their eyes as it was going. But that's the general gist of the myth. And all of a sudden, just the arcade cabinets disappeared.
Overnight,
just
right?
Done with, yeah. There was never any sight of it again.
Actually, the podcast The Truth did a really cool fictional story based on the concept of Polybius with like a fake interview.
I remember
and all
you
this
mentioning
stuff.
That.
Yeah, definitely check that out. Truth's an awesome narrative podcast, but their story based on it was really clever.
I want to say at least three other podcasts in the Dark Mist Collective with us have done a Polybius episode.
Well, they did like a fictional story where they kind of like made up, like they did it in a mockumentary style. So they used
what if it's real, Greg? What if it's real?
Yeah, they just don't want they don't want the powers that be to know that
the truth is out there and you don't know it.
So in terms of collecting the data, yes, Josh, this sounds like the 1984 movie, The Last Starfighter.
You're welcome.
Which, if anybody's unfamiliar with it, it's kind of like also Ender's Game where, oh shit, I'm not going to get into why it's like that. But anyway, The Last Starfighter is, Holden, correct me if I'm wrong, it's been a while since I've seen this on, I forgot what channel
Holden,
it came
you're
on.
Old. Please tell us if
no,
we're right.
No, it's not that. It's not that. I mean, I think this is even before Holden's time. But it
yeah,
was.
Yeah, I think it is. I'm kind of trying to remember. I'm Googling it as
it's 1984. So it is a video game about a kid that is so good at a particular video game called The Last Starfighter that he gets recruited by a government agency that has been tracking the game to fight an alien armada. So it's the kind of like the premise of Polybius was gearing up some people to be in The Last Starfighter just to see who can resist the seizures the best. But yeah, there's some similarities. But to this point, The Last Starfighter came out after the supposed time that Polybius was in circulation. So I wouldn't say that it would be a influence unless it wasn't real. So,
or the movie is about Polybius.
Yeah, there we go.
Ooh, somebody's in the know.
Too spooky for me.
So in 19, the earliest I could find in reference to Polybius was a lot of people online saying, and there's a whole wiki dedicated to Polybius, by the way. You can go check that out. Yeah,
cool.
Whole, not Wikipedia page, a whole
wiki, like its own fandom section.
Yeah.
Cool.
And the earliest supposed mention of Polybius was on a Usenet forum, which, if anybody's unfamiliar with it, it was pretty much the precursor to the internet. It's like a bulletin board system.
It's a bulletin board system, right.
Yes. And in 1994, somebody supposedly talked about Polybius and had a mention of it. I dug as much as I could to find the post because there was a whole bunch of different, like, you know, coin-op Usenet forums that got converted into web pages that you could look at the archives of them. But nobody could actually link the 1994 reference to it that I could find. If anybody in the crowd like that listens finds it, email us, and then I'll gladly give you a shout-out about that because that would be invaluable. But the best thing that I can figure out right now is that some people may have been confusing it with something called the Polybius Enigma, which was happening in 1994 on Usenet. And the Polybius Enigma was kind of the first alternate reality game based around the Pink Floyd album, The Division Bell. It was
Is it like a D&D campaign or something?
No, it's not like a D&D campaign. It's like, I'm trying to think of a good ARG. Cloverfield was a good example of it.
Ah,
it was
okay,
this
kind of
like viral marketing thing where they throw in stuff that isn't directly talking about this product, in this case, the Division Bell by Pink Floyd, but it has so many references to it that it has to be connected to it to the point where there might be some like Easter eggs
that's cool.
or something about to release.
That's awesome.
And there was guy named Polybius that kept posting things about it. And even during Pink Floyd shows, they had references to the Polybius Enigma in their light shows. And that gave Polybius credence that he was in the know or was somebody that was involved with Pink Floyd, even though David Gilmour denied it. Now, I went too much into that. That's still a really cool subject, but I think that's where people were confusing Polybius with Polybius. It's easy to do.
Yeah, I see.
Especially
that.
If people are referencing back to the 1994.
Huh.
Now, the first actual reference that can be tracked back is in 2000 for coinop.org, which is just a reference site for coin-operated video games, any sort of arcade. Mm-hmm. And it was an entry that pretty much listed everything I was talking about in the game. And said at the end of it, that's all I can get about this. Here's the copyright. If anybody has any more information about this, please let me know. And that like sparked the fire that turned this into a giant urban legend. Somebody found this and was confused about it. Mm. And it even included the whole Men in Black visiting the arcade cabinet. Generally is not something you would see on a coin-op website that's just documenting all different types of video game cabinets. It's kind of weird. So obviously people like ran with that. Afterwards, it turns out that they had a little bit of an add-on to this story when a man in 2006 named Stephen Roach, on coinop.org posted a post saying that, hey, I made this game. And he said that he worked for the Zenislution company, who was based out of Germany, and they were approached by some South American company that had him under an NDA to even talk anything about who it was, saying that they had this grand idea to make a vector, a game based on this new type of graphics, which people said was either vector or raster, which the difference is, I can't really tell you too much, but in terms of Adobe Photoshop, raster is essentially what you would do of just a regular paint. You dip the color onto the screen, it makes a bunch of pixels that eventually have a gradient that make it look like a piece of paint.
Okay.
Vector is more like line work.
Yes.
Like, you know that old tanks game where it was just like you're going through.
Oh, fuck, I love that game.
Or I guess just any time where you see like you're going down a pit with just squares.
Tron's
geometric shapes.
Tron's a vector game.
Yeah, exactly. That is a vector game. And anyway, this company said they wanted to work on it, but it caused a whole bunch of seizures and all the things they said had happened in Polybius, minus some of like, you know, the suicidal thoughts and stuff. And it was just such an embarrassment. They immediately pulled it off the test market, which happened to have been in Oregon, of all places, near Portland. That wasn't even a popular district of Portland. Don't know why they picked that one. They pulled it, and so they wouldn't face lawsuits or anything like that. And it was such a stain on the face or like the reputation of Zenislution that they just disbanded the company. Now, this happened in March of 2006. This guy posted this. In April of 2006, somebody actually landed an interview with Stephen Roach. And
oh, did they?
It kind of tanked his story because there were a lot of inconsistencies, mainly the fact that everything he said was line for line from Wikipedia. Now, a lot of people think that maybe it was updated after he did the interview, but it just didn't seem like he knew what he was talking about.
How convenient.
Yes. So I'm not really giving any credence to this Stephen Roach guy. I think he just maybe was like, I wasn't expecting to get interviewed. And he just wanted to see how far he could go with it. He was pulling an EGM. So he didn't try anything after that. Now, getting into this actual game, there was no copyright for it. Like, let's dispel it a little point by point. The whole Men in Black aspect of this is kind of interesting because there may have been people going to different video game cabinets and in building this story, I'm going to say right now, I don't think this game existed. There have been pictures online of the actual cabinet, but all the pictures that I've seen have been inconsistent with each other. And there's even been a supposed ROM of the game, but supposedly it's very hard to make a ROM on a computer from an arcade game in terms of like translating it from one language to another. But this Men in Black visiting the cabinets, it's true the FBI may have visited some arcades because of illicit gambling using arcade systems. Now, as a little reference, last time I was in Tokyo, we went to a pachinko parlor. And the way it works is you cannot actually get a payout from pachinko in the parlor. No? Gambling is legal there. Mm-hmm. So what they do is, it's kind of like a Chuck E. Cheese. They give you, you win a certain amount of pachinko balls. And if you don't know what a pachinko machine is, it's like a vertical pinball machine. If it lands in certain holes, you may win more like little steel balls. And you can go turn those in for a ticket. So it's just like your tickets that you get if you're a Chuck E. Cheese.
Gotcha.
Which, by the way, fucking bullshit now. Chuck E. Cheese, I've talked about this before, not a band. He's a VJ now. Not even a DJ. He's just a VJ. It's so annoying. Actually, the pizza's still good, though.
I was going to say the pizza's good, but that was actually where I spent the majority of my time playing these video games as a kid growing up.
Well, Alex and I were testing the rumor of whether you actually needed a kid to go into Chuck E. Cheese anymore.
And you don't, correct?
No, they don't. They give the kid a stamp, and then if you don't have a kid, they don't give you a stamp. But you have to match the kid with your stamp, and then you can walk out. It's a good system.
Yeah.
But so afterwards, you get your tickets, and you can get a prize at the counter. Now, what would this prize be? Instead of a plushie from Chuck E. Cheese, you get a... like say a piece of candy or a nice cool little like lighter, like just a Bic lighter, and you walk out with it. And you may have dropped $200 into these machines just to walk out with a lighter. However, there could be a vendor right across the street from that pachinko parlor that happens to buy a specific type of lighter for $400. So that's the way they get around it.
Now, that's cool.
Now the way an arcade parlor would work is they just look at the high scores of that particular arcade machine and they pay out the person with their initials and the high scores. Mm. Like somebody would get the high score, go to the counter, register their name as the ones with these initials on the high score that just says like ass, you know, all the way down 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. But, afterwards they'll get a payout in the back of the arcade afterwards.
Gotcha.
Now the FBI was, or whoever was involved with the illicit gambling, was probably getting privy to this and was visiting and taking down the information,
the high scores,
of the high scores.
Yeah.
SEC deal with gambling?
ATF maybe? I don't know. I don't know who does that.
I don't know.
I don't know. Who's the one?
It's the man.
I'm gonna look it up.
Who dropped the ball in all the gambling for Steam and the CSGO skins?
CSGO.
Yeah. But anyway, so that could have been like the little grain of truth to the Men in Black visiting. It was actually FBI agents trying to bust any gambling ops behind that.
Makes sense.
And then afterwards, there were actual deaths associated
FBI.
With video games.
I think it's the FBI.
Okay, cool.
The female body inspectors?
Shut up. So anyway, afterwards, they had some games involved. Like people died playing one game called Berserk, and it has... it's appropriate if you've read the manga or watched the anime,
yeah.
But it's not like Guts. You're not actually, it's not based on either of those. It was just happened to be a game where somebody was so hopped up that both people had heart palpitations and ended up dying after playing the game because they exhausted the shit out of themselves to the point where I've read that somebody may have played for about 28 hours.
Holy shit.
I don't believe that. Nowadays, I believe that, like, you know, somebody in South Korea in a like
yeah,
an internet cafe
say,
dying from
playing
StarCraft
League of Legends,
too much.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, LOL would be, I guess,
yeah,
order,
that's another one.
Straight. And that's more just, you know, staying up. I mean, just like the guy who recently died. Well, I guess it was like a year or so ago now that died from doing a 24-hour stream, you know, because he was just not taking care of himself. And it was more about the fact that he was staying up and chain smoking for 24 straight hours. And
yeah.
Like,
oh, wow.
Somebody needs to tell these people that are doing like the 24 hour streams. And Greg, you've done one.
I did one too, but I'll tell you what I did. I did my research and I got up and took a walk every 2 hours. I ate, I constantly had fresh fruits and vegetables nearby. I was constantly snacking. I did, you know, there's tons of precautions you can take to be able to get through it. You know, will I do it again? Probably not, but
we were,
I mean,
stupid. I've done it for 3 years and every year I still drank beer, coffee, garbage, like, and by hour 20, I basically hate everyone around
but
me.
Then yeah. You called me in to be a pinch hitter. You get pinch hitters to kind of like take over. So
yeah, I'm still the room, though.
Be a human for a little bit.
Oh, I definitely don't have the control in my hand for 24 hours. That, because I'm too busy like doing the social media, bidding for stuff. Like, I'm doing, our office kind of runs the operation.
I still feel really sorry when you got us on to play Jackbox for your stream while you went away, and we probably tanked that, but you know.
It was like 3 a.m. You were fine.
Yeah.
Them donations. But yeah, so Holden, you know, like it's playing for 24 hours is not a small feat. Andrew WK
it's
played
hard.
Fucking drums
for 24 hours.
For 24
right.
hours, but he had pinch hitters that came in.
Yeah.
As long as the drums don't stop. So that actually has happened, but in terms of Polybius happening and like there's being this one neatly like rap story with a bow on it where all of these elements are in it. I don't think it actually happened. I would love for that to be the case, but if you want to get immersed in that sort of lore, there is actually a PlayStation VR Polybius game that came out in 2016 that you can play.
Oh, I was going to mention that. Unlike Shang Long, what they did the correct thing, which is come out with a really trippy, awesome game called Polybius on PlayStation VR. And by all accounts, I've heard it's fantastic. I really want to get my hands on it.
It comes with all the symptoms, too. It is authentic as fuck.
That's awesome.
You can just get seizures and all that.
Oh, sounds like
not
a good
true.
Time.
Not true. So that wraps up Polybius, but as a little bit of like just another creepy.
A whistle letter?
Some other creepy elements that have happened more recently, like, you know, you're going to find so many different creepypastas online, but video game ones that really stick out in my mind, especially ones that happened back then, was Lavender Town Syndrome. I love this one because it's involved with Pokemon Red and Green. I say Red and Green because it was the Japan version, not the Red and Blue after it made it over to the US. Yeah. It was supposedly the fact that when you go into Lavender Town, which is, you know, Pokemon is a fun, like happy-going adventure game, yeah. But when you go into Lavender Town, I'm actually gonna have a clip playing right now for like a second so you can hear it. Don't care if it gets sued by Nintendo Company or Game Freak, whatever. But it's gonna be Lavender Town's song is so creepy in its own. Like, do you remember it at all, Holden? It's the one of two songs that really stick out in my head.
I'd have to hear it, but yeah, I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's this so drab macabre theme that when you were talking about E.T. making you depressed, I felt like that's how Lavender Town worked, like the way the music sounded. But, you know, if anything, that might be the best track on the entire soundtrack because it elicited that strong of an emotion in you.
That's
the way I'd look at it.
Yeah.
But supposedly, the soundtrack sounded a little bit different in the original version to the point where if you waited long enough, it would change, get more drab, more macabre, to the point where people got clinical depression and supposedly killed themselves from playing this.
It might have been because they were trying to give somebody 500 fucking lemonades to get the leaf on.
I need to get the Pokescope, man,
right?
To see the ghost.
Jesus.
And also, I mean, it's just, I love this one. It's not true. It turns out that this stems from like the early 2000s, the first time anybody saw this. And it may have even been from a Tumblr post, but it felt so real when I saw that. It was just like believable. And then somebody, you know, life imitates art and made that like song. And made a whole like Let's Play involving the Lavender Town Syndrome original Pokemon Red and Green. And also there was, I think Greg might be familiar with this, in the Haunted Majora's Mask cartridge.
Yes. I actually am not very familiar with that one. I've heard most of the stuff today. That one I'm not very familiar with.
You know what it's about?
Yeah, that's straight creepypasta where it's just about it's online. Just go read it. It's kind of a long read, but it's pretty entertaining, especially if you like to get creeped out. And yeah, it's essentially the tale, a yarn spun about a haunted cartridge, Majora's Mask, that I guess a kid died or something, and they're saying like the ghost of the kid is inside the game, and the game starts like, and that makes a lot of sense for Majora's Mask because that is also just a very weird, off-putting, creepy game as a whole, that it just has a lot of bizarre kind of mystique to it. It's just got a lot of weird elements to it. It's like Zelda, but yeah, it's not Zelda. It's very strange.
And that game shares a tie for my favorite Zelda game.
And I was going to say, when you were talking earlier about video games that made you write down codes and things like that, that's the last one that I remember because I didn't play that until probably about 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah.
I missed out on that.
Goddamn bunny ears from the Postman.
Oh my God. That is my favorite Zelda game, but that was one where I had to sit down and write down things for that game, and I fucking love that game, dude.
But then you should play Dark Souls. I've been trying to get you two to play Dark Souls for the past year. God
damn
it.
I did play it. I fucking hated it.
No, I
don't play a game that's hard for hard's sake. Fuck that shit.
It's not hard. Okay, I'm not getting into this.
If you'd like to actually get a better explanation than hard for hard's sake, check out the Wizard and the Bruiser episode on Dark Souls. Right?
Nice! There you go.
I know it's a controversial opinion. It's just not my kind of game. It just drove me crazy.
So anyway, now the game, it was originally green text on 4chan, but the cool part about it is somebody actually went out of their way to make a few YouTube videos of the supposed game, and it's creepy as hell. You can look it up on YouTube. Look up like I think it's called like Ben's Majora's Mask or something like that.
Cool.
But even more recently, lastly, there was a game that started. This is clearly just creepypasta, but I'd suggest everybody, you know, at least check it out. the most recent one is so creative because somebody has made a creepypasta in the form of a YouTube Let's Play, and it's called Pets Cop. It came out last year, and it's this guy that found a cartridge for, a CD for a PS2 game called Pets Cop, and he starts playing it, and I think it's like a 12-episode series, and it goes through it turning into like kind of a Pokemon-esque game where you have to catch certain pets and stuff like that, to it being about a bunch of child murders. So it's just really interesting the way he framed it, because he's not making it seem like it's just a creepypasta, because nobody can get a copy of this game, but there's so many theories going on online. It's really fun if you want to get a little bit creeped out involved video games. I think that wraps it about up. Holden, do you have anything else to say before we do our how-tos and goodbyes?
No, I think that's it. I mean, we covered a lot of stuff here, so hell yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me on. That was fantastic.
All right, before we ask everybody how to reach you, Holden, I have a very special request. One of our friends, Nick, is a big fan of the show, and we were just wondering if you could get a Holdenator's hoe for him.
Nick, what's happening, buddy? Ho!
Thank you very much.
There you go. Just for
you, just
Nick.
Made his few hours of listening to this. So, Holden, how can everybody find out more about you?
Check out Wizard and the Bruisers, the podcast. You can check it out, I think, on any app or whatever. I'm always streaming twitch.tv/Holdenatorsho. That's the best way to find me.
I am on there a few times. So
thank you very much. And then Holdenators on Twitter, Instagram, I think it's just HoldenMCM. But either way, the best way to catch me is on Twitch.
I do want to say
links in the show notes. I mean, in the show description for y'all.
I do want to say, if you haven't checked out The Wizard and the Bruiser,
so good.
It's Holden and Jake Young. They're fucking fantastic. My first introduction to the show was Ryan pulling me aside and just going, dude, you need to listen to The Haunted Mansion. And a quick little backstory about me is I worked in Disney World. So,
awesome.
I am very, like...
Okay. He rode the rails on the boat.
Shut the fuck up, Ryan. I'm like, kind of pretentious when it comes to, like, Disney lore and things like that. And your Haunted Mansion episode, I will say, blew me away. I loved every second of it. It was awesome. But you also cover things like Game of Thrones, The Empire Strikes Back, Mass Effect, like, all these different games that, like,
your
we mentioned
Kingdom
before.
Hearts one. Kingdom basically Hearts. Made me fire up the game for the first time in years. That was so amazing.
And
the
one I'm listening to right now is Calvin and Hobbes, and I fucking love that one too. So
yeah. It's a good show.
Check them out, Wizard and the Bruiser. They're on Patreon, they're on Stitcher, whatever you guys want to check them out. Be sure to do that.
All right, gush done. And but thank you very much for having if you guys want to reach us, obviously all the regular bullshit. What is it? Rumorfliespodcast.com.
Rumorfliespodcast.com at Rumorflies on social media. We are also still on Google Plus. We always love the shout outs there.
And you know what? Video games, if we're gonna plug it too, twitch.tv/instant3play.
That is not Rumorflies, damn it. No, I'm just kidding. You're allowed to shamelessly plug it.
You know, if you want to go on i3p and play some Jackbox with us, or just watch us play some horror games terribly, that's fine too.
You should. They're it's actually a really fun stream.
When you're not
it's
watching
really
Holden, you know,
and,
of course.
Yeah, when Holden's not on.
So anyway, Holden, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This was extremely fun. We wish you the best. And I guess I'm Ryan.
I'm Josh.
And I'm Greg.
Bye.
Bye.
This episode's closing song is by Holden's band, The Cowmen. It's Shovel. It's off of their latest release. And if you like it, you can check out more at thecowmen.bandcamp.com. So that is Shovel by The Cowmen.